Welcome to the Weekly Leader Podcast, episode number 18. I'm Peter Mello from Sea Fever Consulting and the founder and editor of the Weekly Leader blog and podcast. And my podcasting partner is Pam Fox Rollin from IdeaShape. Hi, Pam. How are you today?
Excellent. How are you, Peter?
I'm doing really well, thanks. How's the weather out there in California?
It is sunny in Sunnyvale.
It's nice here, too. What's new? Anything new going on?
Well, I've been thinking a lot lately about leaders telling stories and what a critical role that is in any leadership context. And there was something the other day on the Fast Company website. Have you seen their 30-second MBA shtick that they do?
I have.
There are little videos that they have, I think a little presumptively named, but that's okay. And they do very short clips with folks from all sorts of corporate walks of life talking about critical issues in leadership and management. And so there was one from a VP at Intel the other day who was saying figuring out what the arc of that big story is the number one job of leadership. And I believe it. And that's just been brought home to me the last couple of weeks in works that I've been doing with teams.
From so many perspectives, obviously, from communicating the vision, but also just in how you act on a daily basis with people. And our weekly leader this week will tell us a few stories about, and many of our weekly leaders tell us stories about their experiences that are educational, illustrative of their leadership. I agree with you. This week, just a few leadership news items. I just got an email the other day, today, from the Center for Creative Leadership about a free teleseminar that they have coming up. And, you know, it's free, so it might be worth checking out. It's called Transforming Your Organization, and it's the Cone Story. And it's October 1st at 1 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time. And it's just, it's an opportunity to hear a bunch of executives talk about a change management program that they went through. And it is done with a few of the consultants, I believe, from the Center for Creative Leadership. So might be worth a listen. I signed up for it. Thought I'd check it out. Last week, I think it was, right, the president addressed some students, and there was a whole brouhaha about that leading up to it. I don't think we discussed that because we've been off for a week. You familiar with that?
I am, and I at first thought, oh, this is, you know, it's really interesting. I can see why some people might be upset, even though I can't, I probably wouldn't share that. But then I read the speech before it came out, and I was like, who could possibly be opposed to this? It really fit in with the theme that he's also been talking about yesterday on financial responsibility, but it really talked with kids about taking responsibility for yourself and using the resources around you, accessing those resources, whether family or school, to help you grow, but that's a responsibility for yourself. And I'm like, what are people so afraid of?
Yeah, you know, I guess some of it, some of the things that kind of set people off were some of the materials that, educational materials that supported it. You know, what struck me about this whole thing is if we can't have the president as a role model for students, we're in deep trouble.
Especially this president, my goodness.
Yeah, well, any president, I think, particularly, if we're going to have this issue about presidents talking to students, we are in deep trouble. You know, we always try to, you know, sports stars don't want to be role models and, you know, movie actors don't want to be role models. Well, if we can't have the president as a role model, I think that we might want to reappraise our value system. But anyway.
Just a side note on that. I asked my second grader whether they listened to it and how it was. And he said, well, we tried to, but we couldn't get the TV recorder thing to work, and so it just stuttered, and then we all had to stop. So our schools in the year 2009 may not actually be in condition to actually receive a message from the president.
Yeah, sad as it may be, I think you're right.
And we're in the heart of Silicon Valley, so.
The final news item I have here, and I'm not going to get into any policy discussion or anything like that, but the healthcare seems to continue to be on the top of the agenda. And, we've talked a bunch about adaptive leadership and the challenges, and it is interesting to kind of see how this all plays out with respect to the president, how he's handling it, and members of Congress. So nothing in detail to discuss there, but if you read the newspapers and you frame it up from the perspective of examining how people are dealing with this issue from a leadership perspective, I think it can be kind of interesting. We have a weekly leader website of the week is the MIT Sloan Management Review. So we've gone with a few more obscure websites recently, but this one maybe people are familiar with. It's a website that complements the magazine. Do you subscribe to the magazine?
I get their articles online.
Yeah, and that's one of the good things about this website and why we've put it up there today. Great stuff. I have in the past subscribed to the magazine. The website is has a lot of great information on it. There is an emphasis on innovation, sustainability, and actually some design issues, especially in the last issue. I think they talk a lot about design. And you might be familiar if you read the Wall Street Journal with periodically they come out with a Wall Street Journal MIT Sloan Management Review special section, which again is often focused on innovation and sustainability. But throughout, there's a lot of articles about leadership in there. How to manage virtual teams, I think, is one that's currently up there. And yeah, I think it's a good website. They're on Twitter. You can follow them at MITSMR on Twitter. Anything else you want to add?
Yeah, they've got great resources. There's a little-known podcast that listeners might enjoy, especially if we've got some listeners who are MBA students. The MBA students at the MIT Sloan School have a podcast, and they do a monthly report. They're usually, you know, 8 to 13 minutes kind of thing, and they highlight something that the students have been learning and working on, and I enjoy it. I enjoy hearing the voices from that perspective. The last few, one was on combating the clean water crisis. There was one on working for economic empowerment for AIDS victims, about the future of the smart card. So they talk about the places that they've been on their study trips, and I enjoy hearing their voices. So cool. You can look for that on iTunes.
Mm-hmm. Cool. We'll put a link up in the show notes to the iTunes as well. I haven't listened to that, so I look forward to tuning in. Excellent. Your research finding of the week, what do you got?
Okay, so this is from Francis Flynn, who is an associate professor of organizational behavior at Stanford GSB, and Scott Wiltermuth, who's a PhD student there. And I'm going to include up a link to Francis Flynn's site because he's got a good site and he actually has copies of some of his research that are available public for free. So that's a super resource. This one I thought was particularly interesting given our common interest in social media and leadership. And it's called Who's With Me? False Consensus, Advice Networks, and Ethical Decision-Making in Organizations. And it is being polished up for final submission to the Academy of Management Journal. There is a summary of it from, as it turns out, the MIT Sloan Management Review, so we'll put up a link to that because it's available for free. So it focuses on what's called the false consensus effect, which in short is a logical fallacy, which means we think it and it ain't so, where individuals believe that their own opinions and beliefs are more common in the general public or relevant group than they actually are. So they think other people agree with them far more than they actually do. And this has been shown just again and again. And what was neat about this study that Professor Flynn did is it looked at how central people were in social networks, and it discovered that centrality in a social network strengthens rather than weakens that bias. So there's a blind spot for people who are at the centers of social network where they think that they are more in touch with the opinions of others than they actually are. And this happens for a couple of reasons, we think. One of them is one that I talk often with senior teams about, and it seems to come as a surprise for folks, is that the research clearly shows that in meetings, people tend to talk about things that everybody already knows. The more people around the table have a piece of information already, the more likely it is to be discussed. The less broadly shared a piece of information is, the less likely it is to be discussed, which unfortunately is, you know, the purported purpose of many meetings is to share our unique information and together develop a richer pool of knowledge. And what the research says is that that doesn't happen very often. And so part of the false consensus effect is the reality that people tend to talk about things they agree about and are less likely to talk about things that they disagree about. So people presume agreement. They fill in the silence. And it was interesting that they did this study with three very different groups and found precisely the same results. They did it with graduate business students, of course, very easy to study right there. They did it with executive education students who tend to be folks that are pretty well advanced in their careers. And they also did it with employees in the marketing department of a large manufacturing company, and they found all the same results. So the watch out for leaders is do not assume that people agree with you. Go check it out.
And what do we do to avoid that?
We ask, right? So and I would say there's a couple of stages. One is to be aware of our own assumptions. It's hard to ask if we don't even think, oh, wait a sec, I'm assuming here that people want this new computer system, or I'm assuming that people embrace the idea that diversity is a great thing to have on our team. And so first it's to be mindful, find some moments of peace and quiet to actually reflect on our own assumptions and even log some of them down, and then to ask folks, so what do you see diversity brings to our team? Or what do you see as the pros and cons of this system? Or here's how I'm seeing it. What am I missing? I'm sure that there's a point of view that I'm not understanding here.
So people, we'll have links in the show notes to both the website of the week, which also contains the research finding of the week. And by the way, that applies, I think in the title of the article it says, or somewhere here, it says social networks provide greater access to information, which improves people's judgment and decision-making, right? Not always, according to some recent research. And I think what they're talking about there is social networks, not necessarily technology-based social networks, right? They're talking about social networks as in the three groups that were part of the research.
Right, and how centrally connected in a general social network sense that they are to their peers. Who are the people who are, people describe as at the center of social contact versus people who are more at the periphery. However, and I'm glad you brought that up, I think that our Twitter and Facebook culture does contribute to that. And often, you know, you're linked to somebody, you guys have been having great chats about leadership for a couple months, and then all of a sudden something pops up and you go, wow, I never realized that person thought that way. I just assumed that they were kind of on the same page as me. And I'm always grateful when people post things that are a bit controversial or have their own opinion in them, because it reminds me that they've got their whole own sets of points of view.
Right. Well, I think there's an old saying, too, that goes with this. Very old saying about assuming things. But anyway, we'll skip that. We're back with our weekly leader this week, and I'm really pleased to present to you Trey Gowdy. He's from South Carolina, and let's hear his story.
Picks you out of a lineup after watching Law and Order, because you were the best one. My smoking gun. And how do you flirt with the prettiest girl in the entire room when you don't know what to say? Well, sometimes I do.
This week, our weekly leader is Trey Gowdy from South Carolina, a friend I met a few years ago. Trey, how are you?
I'm doing great, Peter. Hope you are.
Thanks. I'm doing real well. Trey, why don't you help our listeners understand who you are and what you do?
Well, I am the married father of two. I live in Spartanburg, South Carolina. I am currently the solicitor of the 7th Judicial Circuit, which is a fancy way of saying district attorney, which is what virtually every other state calls my job. If you've seen Law and Order, we're the second half of the show, with law enforcement being the first 30 minutes. Prior to being elected circuit solicitor, I was a federal prosecutor for 6 years. Briefly have been in private law practice, clerk for a federal judge. After law school, I'd say 90% of my legal career has been spent in a criminal courtroom on behalf of either the United States or the state of South Carolina.
What's your mom and dad do?
My father is a pediatrician. He doesn't practice now. My mom was a stay-at-home mom, took care of my three sisters and me. Interestingly, Peter, my parents grew up very poor in a agricultural part of South Carolina that we refer to as the PD. They're from a little city called Lake City. My mother's father had a sixth grade education, and her grandfather was a sharecropper, and my father had to go to work when he was 12, delivering newspapers, not for spare money to go to a movie or to buy gas, but if he ever aspired to go to college, he was going to have to pay for it himself. So he got a paper route. And although he is a medical doctor, is not a college graduate. He did not have enough money to finish getting a degree. He took all the math and science he could and then went to the Medical University of South Carolina. And back then, you could do that. So he's a medical doctor, but he's not a college graduate.
How fascinating. Are you the first one in the family to pursue first a legal and career and a political career?
Much to my father's chagrin, I am the first attorney in the family. I'm not aware of anyone else who's ever stood for public office. We have more of an agricultural background. My father kind of flipped the table for us by getting a postgraduate degree. I do have three sisters, all of whom are college graduates. Politics, my grandfather was interested in it. My father is more than interested in it, but in terms of putting your name on the ballot and letting people say yes or no, I'm the first one crazy enough to do it.
Give us a quick tour of what your day consists of today and not necessarily today, but in your current position. And also your management or leadership responsibilities.
Well, we have an office that consists of 65 different employees, about 25 of whom are attorneys. We have an administrative staff of a dozen or so. We have investigators or former law enforcement officers who are still deputized. They still have arrest powers that work in the office. We have diversion programs like juvenile arbitration and pretrial intervention. We have a drug court. We have a drug mother court for expectant mothers who are addicted to controlled substances. So part of my job is enforcement, and part of my job is prevention. And a typical day would probably divide into whether or not I'm in court or out of court. If I'm in court, we start at 9:30. If it's a murder trial or a capital trial, it could last days, including weeks. If it's a death penalty trial, you're in court Saturdays and Sundays. Under South Carolina law, you don't stop once you begin a death penalty trial. You go all the way through. So trial work, you know, the phone doesn't ring. There are no emails to respond to until you get out of court. It's a different kind of feeling when you're not in trial, when you got 65 employees, there are management issues, there are other elected officials that have concerns. It's very tough budget times for South Carolina. My employees had to be furloughed for 6 days. So there are budgetary concerns, there are community issues, you're being invited to go to this school, you're being invited to, you know, the mayor wants to eat lunch to discuss this. It's, if you looked at it like a law firm, we are the largest law firm in Spartanburg.
And you would be the managing partner of that?
Yeah, I would be the managing partner, you are correct.
So throughout your legal career, has there been any significant event that really has, you feel, has shaped your leadership style?
Well, I think the event that made me become a prosecutor was having a friend murdered in Charlotte, a gentleman by the name of Jeff Adams, who was a wonderful, beautiful human being. I had no interest in being a prosecutor, or certainly hadn't thought about it until Jeff was murdered, then riding back from his funeral, you have one of those conversations with yourself where you ask, am I doing what I'm supposed to be doing, and am I making a difference? And that's what kind of spurred me to call that old federal judge I used to work for and say, can you help me get a job as a prosecutor? And he did. I have been fortunate to be around incredibly successful people, from Governor Dick Riley, who served as superintendent or secretary of education under President Clinton, Billy Wilkins, who is the chief judge of the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, Ross Anderson, who was my boss for 2 years. When you are around successful women and men, you have a wonderful opportunity to pick certain characteristics of their leadership and try to apply it to your own life. I know there was a night in Washington, I was at the airport. Governor Riley, Secretary Riley, was stuck at the airport with me, and none other than Homeland Security Tom Ridge came over and spoke to Governor Riley and said, here, let me try to help you get on a plane and get back to South Carolina. Secretary Riley made absolutely certain that his no-name anonymous friend, being me, who was also stuck in the airport, was able to go with him. He would have been well within his rights. He was a much more important man than I was or am, but he turned around and said, I've got somebody else with me. And as fate would have it, we flew into a different city and we rode back to Greenville together. And here's a man that was governor of the state of South Carolina, secretary of education under a United States president, and offered a slot on the United States Supreme Court. And in the 2-hour drive back to Greenville, we discussed every political character in the history of South Carolina, and I never heard him utter a negative word about anyone. That is 2 hours that impacted me a lot, that you can rise to political heights and still be a very good, decent person in the process.
How do you view your own leadership style? How do you characterize your leadership style?
Well, what I try to do is, number one, lead by example. Don't ask people to do anything you're not willing to do yourself. The leadership characteristic that I admire the most is humility, a willingness to serve others, competence. I think you cannot ask people to follow you solely by virtue of your position. The fact that I am the solicitor might give me the power to make them do what I want them to do, but that's not why I want them to do it. I want them to be persuaded that I am correct, that my ideas are correct. So positional power or personality and competence, I would rather them follow me because they trust me and they think I'm competent at what I do. Honesty, sense of humor, courage, and I guess alongside humility, the characteristic that I admire the very most is a willingness to lose, a willingness to have, by worldly standards, a loss. It's how you calibrate success. And there are lots and lots of folks who have lost either criminal cases or political races in terms of a vote count, but history judged them a tremendous success, and I would rather be in the latter group.
You have probably one of the most stressful jobs I could really imagine, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year job. Where do you look for your support, your leadership support? Who do you turn to? How do you kind of get away from it all? So let's turn first to who do you turn to?
For leadership help, there are judges both at the state and the federal level that I think once they trust you and they realize that the conversation will be confidential and you're not going to quote them on it, that's a wonderful resource to go to. Other people who have either been district attorneys or been involved in the criminal justice process, that they don't have to worry that you're going to quote them as saying something. And there's several federal judges in South Carolina that I am very lucky to be able to call and say, look, if you were me, how would you handle this? I have colleagues that have been doing it longer than I have been doing it. My colleague Bob Ariel in Greenville, I have a lot of respect for. Tommy Pope, Peter, if you remember the Susan Smith case from South Carolina where she drowned her 2 sons, Tommy Pope prosecuted that case. A wonderful person, great friend, and a classic example of a guy who won, even though the jury did not do what he asked them to do. She was sentenced to life despite Tommy's request for a more severe sentence, but everyone who watched him handle that case viewed him as a success. So professionals that I have respect for, judges that have been where I am but are, have gone on, and in terms of personal energy or a balance, because you are correct, not that my job is hard, it hardens you because you see the man's inhumanity to man. You see,
right,
just when you think there are no depths to which mankind can sink, we'll have an 8-year-old executed in Spartanburg like we had this summer. Right. And my wife, who is an optimistic, believe the best in everyone person, is a not nice counterweight to my cynicism.
So how do you actually, or do you have the opportunity to kind of get away from it all as well, to just take a vacation, to, you know, put everything aside and really break free?
I probably have more of an opportunity to do that than I allow myself. I think you get caught up into thinking that you have to be constantly available and kind of read, you know, the BlackBerry kind of redefines what an emergency is. The last time I decided not to take my BlackBerry to the beach with me, we had a hostage situation, and when I walked back up to the beach house, there had been 15 phone calls from my chief of police, all of which I missed because I was on the beach with my kids. And I think there's just an expectation that as long as you're going to be the DA, we need to be able to find you when we want to find you. I am better on Saturdays and Sundays at saying, you know what, that can wait until Monday. That every call doesn't have to be returned immediately. Actually, ironically enough, when I'm in Aspen, I probably forget about work more than I would anywhere else because there's nobody out there asking you about it. So all you got to do is just flip your BlackBerry off and turn it on in a couple of hours.
You are a golfer, right? Is that an area that you get out on the golf course, and does that take you away from the day-to-day? What other activities? Is golf it, or are there other activities? Obviously, I know you're a family man, too, a dedicated family man, but how do you kind of just clear your mind?
I like to exercise. I think exercise not only is good for the body, it's good for your mind and your soul. I like to do a little something in the mornings to start the day. I do play golf, and that is wonderful on a number of fronts. I get to reconnect with some friends that are busy during the week, and my father plays and my son plays. And on Saturday mornings at 10:30, being able to stick a tee in the ground with your father, who is 70, and your son, who is almost 17, is a huge gift to be able to have three generations walking down the number one fairway. And we try to protect that little, we don't play 18, we just play 9 holes usually, just that hour and a half on a Saturday morning, because you realize, you know, I never knew either one of my grandfathers, and for my almost 17-year-old son to be able to every single week spend at least some period of time with his grandfather is huge. I like to read, and I'm actually okay at, you know, like 24, for instance. 24
okay.
Is so exciting. You can't think about anything else while that show is on. That's right. My only real addiction in life is 24.
I love the golf. I love the idea that you're able to play with your dad and your son. That's fantastic. You are embarking on a new adventure. You are running for the United States Congress, and that's obviously a whole different kettle of fish, as they say. What prompted you to make that decision to pursue a leadership position that would take you, representing the state, and obviously, but take you to outside of the state for a big chunk of your time?
I think it just a willingness to participate in issues that affect our country as a whole, and a desire to do so. With respect to Liberty Fellowship, which I went through, and the Aspen experience, which you and I have both been through, an acknowledgement that even though you may disagree, and in some instances disagree pretty seriously with other folks, if you try hard enough, you can find something you agree on, and you can devote the energies that are necessary to correcting issues under that penumbra or within that penumbra. Last night was a perfect example. To have a congressman from the state of South Carolina stand up and yell, "You lie," to the President of the United States. I understand policy differences, and I understand contrast. It can be done civilly and still be compelling. And the notion that there are more rules and more civility in a death penalty trial than there is in the United States Congress is very disillusioning. So while I do believe what I believe, I've got, you know, last night was instructive. I got two emails from different parts of the country from folks that I had met through a leadership experience. I don't agree politically with either one of them, but they felt comfortable enough to send an email and say, "What happened? Mm. You know, I know you're from South Carolina, and I know you're not like this. Tell me what happened." Dialogue, exchange of ideas. It has to be civil. You can have contrast and still not be so negative and vitriolic about it. I'm like you, and presumably like many, many, many others. I want to see the America that enabled my family to go from a sixth grade education to a medical doctor. I want that dream to be alive for everybody. And at a certain point, you got a couple options. You can sit there and complain about it. You can sit there and say, "Well, I ought to do this, or I might do this." Or you can say, "You know what? I will submit myself and offer myself for public service and be part of the solution."
You obviously already are in public service, and you're taking it to the next level. And I would assume that this decision involves a family meeting of some sort, because you have young children, and this job would obviously take you away from home pretty extensively. Any thoughts on that?
DNA is the most powerful force on earth, I'm convinced. I have a son who desires to be anonymous, and you would never know what his father did, and if I were emperor of the world, you would never know what his father did. I have a daughter that is very active politically. She's on the separate side of most issues from me, but I encourage her activism, and she's very passionate about it. I think my son, you know, wants a dad that's around his last couple of years enough that we don't have any regrets when he goes to college and beyond.
Right.
The hard part was getting my arms around my 12-year-old daughter and being gone a couple of three nights during the week while she's in high school. But my wife, who is the best barometer of what I should do and should not do in my life, was more excited about a bid for Congress than any other government or political prospects that we'd ever discussed before. And when I saw that she was peaceful about it, it gave me great freedom and liberty to pursue it. So we did discuss it, and three people had the veto power, one abstained, and two voted for it.
You're our first political weekly leader we've had on the podcast, and you and I talked a little bit about leadership and how it manifests itself in politics and in campaigns, very different from how it manifests itself maybe in the business world or the nonprofit sector. And it seems like, especially in the heat of a campaign, and you mentioned what happened last night during the president's address, things can get heated and sometimes even maybe cross over a line. You have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, you have to make your mind up before you ever announce for whatever office it is, from county commissioner, county council, up to governor, United States Senate, that these things are non-negotiable. And on election day, I may win, I may lose, but I value my integrity and I value how people perceive me more than I do victory. That success is broader than just having the most number of votes. There are lots of ways to game the system and the job I'm in now. I suppose that there are ways, if I were to invest a lot of money in certain targeted polling, where I could appeal to the worst instincts of this group, or I could try to rally this group, or I could take something out of context. My philosophy is simple. I want to win, and if hard work and good ideas have anything to do with it, I hope I am successful, but I'm not willing to do anything it takes. I value other aspects of my character more than I do being a congressman. I don't want anybody that I have grown up with or that I have served for the past 8 years as solicitor to ever come up to me and say, "You know what, that wasn't fair. What you did or said was disingenuous and not fair." as a prosecutor, the most complimentary word you can get is fair. And for me to jeopardize that, serving the United States Congress, I won't do it. You know, and sometimes I kid with my friends and say, look, I may not be a terribly successful politician. I've been okay as a prosecutor. I may not be a great politician. I'm not going to do and say certain things that folks say you have to do and say.
As you mentioned fairness, what comes to mind to me is perspective. And a lot of times, probably more often than not, perspective becomes people's reality. And, you know, how does that factor in when you're running a campaign like this where somebody might have a different perspective or a different opinion?
When you say people have different perspective of opinion, you mean folks that may be on the other side of the political aisle?
Yes, or even on the other side of a decision. It might not even be you're pro-life. Maybe somebody is, you know, is pro-choice. Whether it's a political party or whether it's an opinion, a perspective of any sort.
Well, that's a great example, although I think there's a certain fatigue with issues that we have debated for 20 or 25 years without much consensus. I was invited to a lunch about a month ago, invited by six women. I'm convinced I was the only Republican in the room, and even on a scale of conservative to liberal, these women would be admittedly moderate to liberal and probably trending liberal. They invited me to lunch because we share a common interest in the well-being of the safety of women with respect to domestic violence and the well-being and the safety of children. So while they were fully supportive of me as a district attorney, they wanted, you know, admittedly, they said, look, you want to go into a different kind of politics. We've always supported you, even though you were in a different party. Let's talk and see whether or not we can continue to support you. And obviously, the issue of abortion comes up. That's an easy one. I mean, they're not going to change my mind, and I'm not going to change their mind. And you have to ask yourself how much energy is worth spent in talking about things where you're not going to change each other's mind. But what do we agree on? Okay, we agree on prevention. We agree on incentivizing adoption, and we agree on education. Why can't we spend our energies making sure we get those three things done and quit arguing about the larger issue where we're never going to convince one another? That's kind of my tack. And I have been very fortunate so far since June. The number of folks who traditionally don't vote in the Republican primary and don't consider themselves to be Republicans are willing to say, you know what, we do disagree on maybe 30%, maybe even 60% of the issues we disagree on. Let's find what we agree on. Let's focus our energies on that. I'm not going to convince you. You're not going to convince me. Although if you do it the right way and you do it with a certain civility, you can certainly have a conversation. I have had my mind changed by people that I respect. And the only way to do that is to have conversations with people you don't agree with.
Right.
So that's part of it. But I keep coming back to the civility of it. The notion that a candidate for Congress in the Republican Party would be invited to a lunch with six fairly liberal ladies in Spartanburg, and we would be able for 2 hours to talk about things we all agree on. I left that luncheon so encouraged that, I mean, there's certain things that, you know, I mean, my wife and I don't agree on.
Sure.
I mean, my best friend and I don't agree on. How much energy do we spend on that? We've got a long list of things that we both want to get to the same place with the same amount of speed, and life is short. So if we could protect women and children, that's a lifetime goal. I mean, how much energy can we spend doing that and forget about the fact that we may not agree on capital punishment or we may not agree on mandatory minimums for drug cases? Put that in a box. Focus on what you agree on. Be civil. Be supportive. Do not be afraid to compliment ideas across the aisle. Got a friend that is a Democrat that's running for mayor in a very large city in South Carolina. I'm very excited about his candidacy. And I think he'd be a fantastic leader. Different party, different region, but he's got the leadership qualities that I think our state needs and, frankly, our country hungers for. I'm just too damn lazy.
to stay and start this fight. That's why I wrote this song. That's why I wrote this song. This is one of those times. And this, that's why I wrote this song.
Well, that was Trey Gowdy. As you could tell from the conversation, he and I met a number of years ago at the Aspen Institute, and that was first part of the interview. We're going to have a second part next week where we discuss a little bit about his experience with a fellowship and participating in programs at the Aspen Institute. Pam, any thoughts about Trey's weekly leader interview?
Well, I was struck by so many things, and one, and this gets to what we were talking about earlier with the research report of the week, is what a tricky thing that is for leaders, because you do want to find those points of agreement so you can have a civil conversation and put people in the context of human and still note the differences and work towards understanding those differences. He really struck me as somebody who has been very thoughtful about both parts of that.
I think you said how much energy you want to spend on issues that we don't agree with. And let's tackle the ones that we do agree on. And there's plenty of those, right? There's plenty of those types of issues where we have an agreement on things we don't have to assume we have agreement on, but we actually do. And he illustrated the case with a story, as you started out this podcast, about a luncheon he had with some women. So, you know, there's many, many issues they don't agree on, but coming away from the luncheon, the core issues are protecting women and children. They do share consensus. And from my experience and spent some time with Trey as well, it was really interesting at the Aspen Institute because we had a wide range of people that participated in our program. And it was interesting to see how, you know, Trey is Republican, and he's running for Congress, U.S. Congress. And in the group, we also had a couple of Democrats that worked in the Clinton administration. One was a speechwriter, and the other one was assistant chief of staff. And, you know, it was just interesting, these two very diametrically opposed political philosophies, and the friendship that seemed to evolve during the course of the week between these individuals. So I think Trey really lives out his belief in what he's telling us here about trying to find common ground. Very charming, very obviously intelligent, and very interesting leader.
Yeah, I'm going to look forward to the rest of the podcast because he really engaged me in a way that I hadn't expected. So I look forward to hearing more of what he has to say.
Yeah, and I also enjoyed, I guess a little concerned that he doesn't find enough time to take off, it seems like, to get away from his job, which is tremendously challenging, stressful job, I would imagine, things you come in contact with. But just the fact that he's able to play golf every week with his father and his son, and the three of them have this time carved out every week to share and get away from it all, I thought was very, very important and very interesting that, you know, we've seen other of our leaders. Admiral Allen rides his bike, and so we have a wide range of leaders who've done different things to kind of get away from it all and recharge their batteries.
Recharge their BlackBerry batteries by turning them off, and plugging them in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So next week we'll hear Trey talk about leadership a little bit more, his experience with the Liberty Fellowship and the Aspen Institute, and a few other thoughts about leadership. Pam, we're almost ready to go live with a new website at Weekly Leader. I hope to have it up in the next few days. I'd be interested in getting people's feedback about the redesign. It's much simplified. There's a lot of information there. It's organized in a slightly different fashion, but there's a lot of rich information up there, and I'm excited about that. So keep an eye out for it. As usual, enjoyed spending time with you and talking about leadership. And next week, we'll have the second part of Trey's interview.
We hope you'll join us in the leadership conversation, and we've given you plenty of ways to do that. You can go over to the website, which is weeklyleader.net, and find the podcast post and put up a comment there. We'd love to hear from you. We have a team of bloggers who are passionate about leadership, and they would love to hear from you as well. So find any post on the blog and engage in the conversation with them. Always email us at podcast@weeklyleader.net, and if you want to record a message and save it to an MP3 file of 5 meg or less, we'll figure out a way to integrate it into the show. We'd love to have your voice on the show as well. Get us on Twitter, and the Weekly Leader is at Weekly Leader. Pam is at PamFR, and I'm at Peter Mello, PeterMello. And in the show notes, we'll have links to all of our other contributors' Twitter IDs. If you use iTunes, we'd really appreciate it if you could rate and review the podcast. And finally, we use PodSafe Music and from the PodSafe Music Network, which is now called Music Alley. The intro for the podcast is Transcends by Trance Blackmon. The intro music for Trey Gowdy's interview was a song called Law and Order by Silent Service. And we're going to close with a great tune by Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings called How Long Do I Have to Wait for You? So thanks for investing your time with us, and we look forward to being with you again next week.
Before